listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
Hello and welcome to The Lyric Feature. We're back after a 10-week summer hiatus, and thanks to Shirley Keane and her evening songs, which kept everybody entertained in the meanwhile. But even though we weren't on air, it doesn't mean we were on a complete break, for all the while during the summer months, our producers were out in the field with their microphones recording for the new series of programmes, which begins today with the Donegal poet Moya Cannon, who first heard of the burn when she was a child. But it wasn't until years later, when she was living in Galway, that she got to spend time there. In this evening's Lyric Feature, in conversation with others who share her love of the burn, and through her poetry, she explores its history, archaeology and landscape. This is A Corner of the Burn.
The first time I came across any mention of the burn was in a children's book, one of the Patricia Lynch books which our mother encouraged us to read. And in this book, she describes a magical country of white hills. Now, I was brought up in a very, very beautiful part of Ireland, Dunfanaghy, County Donegal, and with plenty of hills, but they were all blue, so this seemed very strange. But I owe my real introduction to the burn to Tim Robinson. In the late 70s, he made a beautifully detailed and poetic map of the burn, and I came across it a few years later. I came to live in Galway in 84, and one Sunday, I opened Tim's map and picked out a valley which looked interesting. It held St. Colman's Holy Well, the ruins of what was called the Seven Churches, an early Irish ecclesiastical settlement, and the ruined Corcomroe Abbey. I hitchhiked down to Auchtmama, was enchanted by it, and have been under the spell of the burn since. My name is Moya Cannon. I'm a poet. And in this programme, I'm visiting one of my very special places, the beautifully named Auchtmama, which means the bosom of the gap. This is a valley in the townland of Turlough in the north of the Burn, County Clare. I'm going to meet a number of people who see and know the burn from different angles, all of whom have a very deep knowledge of it and a deep love for it. Auchtmama, in memory of Tim and Mairead Robinson. The bosom of the gap, who so aptly named this valley? Something about it sings, be at ease and rejoice. Scabious, purple knapweed and yarrow sway high above August grass, while eyebright, self-heal and black medic assure us that illness may pass. The holy well's dry stone enclosure shelters fuchsia, wild strawberries and ferns. A source welcomes the hopeful and heart-sore, even in our anxious times. How sheltered the dip in limestone, where three churches nestle in ruins. On a stone font, two animals tussle, necks entwined for a millennium. I have come here so often in trouble, descended the steps to the well, glimpsed a cuckoo fly down the valley, seen three fox cubs at play on the hill. Something about Auchtmama makes me want to lie quietly down in its tangles of flowers and grasses, forget sorrow, and then carry on. We're in Mary Angela Keane's house in Ballyinchin Moor near Listunvarna. You, like myself, are somebody from the outside who came to the burn and fell in love with it, Mary Angela.
Yes, I come from County Cork and we were gardeners.
What initially piqued your interest in the burn?
On the day that I came back from my honeymoon in 1962 to the family hotel, I was told that there were three guests coming on the bus. And the three guests were three ladies in their late 70s. Two were twins and the other was a nun. and she was the spiritual advisor to the old Queen Mother. That was one thing, but as botanists, they were amazing. So they came in the bus, but you need a car in the Burren to see it. And here was I with nothing to do, and I had a car, and I really drove them around the Burren for the full week.
My goodness.
And they knew exactly what they were coming for. And as I say, were great botanists. Just listening to them talking, I was learning and learning and learning, and I thought, what a wonderful place.
But you were very quick to actually share your knowledge of it. You were very generous in sharing your knowledge of it. Can you tell us how that happened?
Well, yes. At that time, in the early 1960s, it would have been May 1962, and there were very few people in Lisdoonvarna. And the hotel that whose family I joined, that stayed open for the whole year. And so we had a small dribble of people coming in. And me, with my newfound knowledge, would tell them what I had. And then I asked them, when they were finished their holiday, could you give me a little report on what you saw and you did? And I collected all of these, and that meant the next guest then that came, what are you looking for? And they're looking for so-and-so. And I could say, yes, if you go down here and go right and turn left, you'll find it.
And many of these, I assume, were also naturalists.
They were all naturalists.
And you're talking now about the 60s, 70s?
I'm talking about the 60s, the 70s and the 80s.
And I think at times the weather isn't brilliant here, even though it's such a beautiful place. And that started you off in another direction.
That started me off. I had a very nice guest staying with us, Dick something, and he was a photographer, and I got a full set of slides from him. And so on a wet day, I would, after dinner, if people liked, and they did like, I could show these slides. And of course, they were thrilled.
It's just amazing how it happened that you garnered all this knowledge, starting from...
That's zero. Right.
Well, of course, you had a background in gardening, but you garnered all this knowledge, and then you shared it.
And then you shared it.
And out of it came your beautiful book on the Burren. Now, you saw many very interesting people coming through your hotel, Keane's Hotel, over the years.
Yes.
But there's one special person in particular that we have in common, actually, a friend in common, and that was the great and good Tim Robinson, who died
Tim,
a few years ago. Do you remember when he came first?
I think he came on his own in the beginning, and he had a very rusty bicycle. And we were familiar with his work because the map of the Aran Islands had come out. And he came maybe every year, and then Mairead came with him. And he was at that point working on the Burren map, which of course he produced. And the people that helped him, he always wrote their name into the map. Quite near here on Mount Elva, there's a stand of trees. And he was going away, I think, within a day, and he hadn't been up to see those trees. And I said, well, they're beech trees. And my name is written in the beech trees.
Have it here. Beechwood. Can you see beechwood?
Oh, yeah.
And upside down beside it, there you are, your name, Mary Angela.
That's right.
What a delight.
Yeah.
What a delight.
Well, we were able to point him in the right direction of what he was looking for. But at the end of the day, it was he was showing us our land.
I'm walking up a farm track, and I'm heading up over the Burren proper with this wonderful flora, and we're just very near St. Coleman's Well. dedicated to a 6th century saint, but like most holy wells, it goes much further back to pre-Christian times. I'm just going to take a few steps down into the well. It's a particularly beautiful, enclosed, little private place. And all around it, there are, the walls have given shelter to fuchsia and montbretia and brambles and ferns. And I know sometimes we have wild strawberries here. And people have left all kinds of little offerings. I see a little Madonna and child here. It's a place where people have been bringing their troubles for many years. One of the first poems I wrote about this area was about the Holy Well, actually. Holy Well. Water returns hard and bright out of the faulted hills. Rain that flowed down through the limestone's pores until dark streams hit bedrock now finds a way back past the roots of the ash to a hillside pen of stones and statues. Images of old fertilities testify to nothing more, perhaps, than the necessary miracle of water trapped and stored in a valley where water is fugitive. A chipped and tilted Mary grows green among rags and sticks. Her trade dwindles. Bad chests, rheumatic pains, the supplications mostly and the confidences of old age. Yet, sometimes, swimming out in waters that were blessed in the hill's labyrinthine heart, the eel flashes past. I have been to this well many, many, many times, and today I'm fortunate enough to have with me the botanist and ecologist Killian Roden. Killian, what are we looking at here?
Well, where are we? We're on the slopes of Uachtarama, and we're looking out over the Burren all around us, the limestone terraces. And we've come up high enough to be sitting on what's really the most characteristic vegetation of the Burren. There are two plants right beside us. The first is the very famous spring gentian with its electric blue, which is very hard to paint for a slightly technical reason. The blue is partly caused by light being emitted from the gentian. So it's not just reflective, and it's very hard to duplicate that when you're painting or even taking photographs. Now, beside the gentian is another plant called the mountain avens. Its Latin name is Dryas octopetula, and Dryas, I think, is the Greek for oak. And it's called that because the little leaves are just like oak leaves. And it's normally a plant where you would have to climb in the Alps 2,000-3,000 metres. Anywhere else in Ireland, there were one or two colonies up above 600-700 metres. But here in the Burren itself and the gentian form carpets at a modest enough height. I suppose we're 100-150 metres high. But look around and you can see all around us the mountain avens, the gentian, the heather, and another lovely plant, the wild juniper. But hidden amongst them are plants like the Burren orchid, as it's called, which comes from the Mediterranean. And it's this combination that baffles plant geographers.
And Killian, can you explain this contradiction for us?
Not really. We start from the fact that here it is. These are how the plants mix together. You draw on various possibilities, such as the Burren has a strange climate with very little frost, which means Mediterranean plants, which don't like winter cold, can survive up here. But at the same time, huge amount of wind and exposure, which probably means that a lot of Central European plants would be less than comfortable here. But to be honest, we're explaining it backwards. We're starting from the fact that you get a very unusual mixture of plants, and then we're trying to invent reasons for it.
And we're looking out at the hills here. This limestone was laid down, what,
320 million years ago?
Yeah. And we've beautiful terraces here. Can you explain how these emerged?
Yeah, you have to remember continental drift, but one of the great discoveries of the 20th century is that continents move around the place. And we're pretty sure, indeed, the evidence is here in the Burren, that 320 million years ago, Ireland, I think, was just south of the equator. So you have to think Caribbean or even Indonesian-like conditions, where you've got the waters are full of corals, and because it's so long ago, very odd-looking fish and shellfish. But up north or down south, there's an ice age going on. So every 5-10 million years, perhaps shorter, the land rises and falls. And we're pretty sure that these terraces, look, I can count 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe at least 5 just from here. Each of those was formed by the rising and falling of sea level. And what you're looking at then is a record of a very ancient ice age. And if we were to look at the rock in detail, we'd see fossil corals, we'd see fossil algae, all of which would indicate a hot, humid environment, much warmer than our waters would be normally. I mean, look out, you can just see the Atlantic there. That's no place for corals to grow in this day and age.
Speaking of water levels, this townland is called Turlough, and the hill above us, where we have a wonderful Iron Age enclosure and a Neolithic burial mound, is called Turlough Hill. Can you explain what exactly is a Turlough?
A Turlough, in a sentence, is a lake that appears and disappears. Why it appears and disappears is that it drains underground. And in winter, when rainfall is very heavy, there's little enough evaporation, the water builds up. But then comes summer, when it's drier, the water table falls, and if it does, the water drains out of the Turlough from the base. So in most Turloughs, such as the one down here in front of us, you have what they call swallow holes. This will be the area where the water disappears.
The ecosystem of the Burren is recognised as being particularly precious. Do you feel that this delicate ecosystem is under threat at the moment?
At this very moment, I'm far more relaxed about the Burren than practically any other habitat in Ireland. And that, I think, is due to the work of Brendan Dunford.
I'm delighted to be able to say that we're going to have a chat with Brendan Dunford later. Oh, Killian, we've been lucky so far, but here comes the rain.
I'm afraid so.
Thirst in the Burren. No ground or floor is as kind to the human step as the rain-cut flags of these white hills. Porous as skin, limestone resounds sea-deep, time-deep, yet in places rainwater has worn it thin as a fish's fin. From funnels and clefts, ferns arch their soft heads, a headland full of water, dry as bone, with only thirst as a diviner. Thirst of the inscrutable fern and the human thirst that beats upon a stone. Hello, Brendan.
Hello, Maya. Good to see you.
How are you? And what a beautiful spot you have
here. It's a lovely spot.
Isn't it a lovely spot.
I'm lucky to have it. And a nice day forward too. Yeah. Nice fresh day out. Yeah. Come on in.
I'm here in Brendan Dunford's house in Killeen, near Lochbunny, in the lowlands of the Burren. I'm just wondering, what brought you originally to this wonderful, wonderful landscape?
I blew in here about 25 years ago now. Came here as a student to do a PhD, and the title of the PhD is what really brought me here. It was the impact of farming on the natural heritage of the Burren. So my job here was to tell the story of how people have shaped this landscape and in turn how the landscape has shaped people. So rather than do it from the remove of Belfield campus, I went native, as they say. I moved down here to County Clare, to the Burren, and I've been here ever since.
There's a lot of talk about ecosystems and preserving ecosystems, and the humans are often cast as the baddies. Would you have a whole different view?
When you do read up about the burn, so many people have published papers and books and poetry and whatever else about it, celebrating, you know, the wonder of the landscape. And it really is the most extraordinary place. But often people were presented as being an aside or often a threat to the archaeology and the ecology of the burn, which, you know, in fairness, was legitimate. But nothing I ever read kind of told the full story of people and place and celebrated the positive role that people can have on a place. So I suppose when I came down here as a student, I was quite open-minded about the place. I didn't know much about it, but I knew very little. So I listened fairly carefully. I read quite a lot. And I suppose what really surprised me was the connection, the deep, deep connection that some people here have with their land. I mean, there's a great story about Paula Caron Cave, where bones found in the cave were connected with a family living nearby. And that's over 3,500 years. That connection has gone on so long. And when you look at the archaeology, it was all built by farmers over 6,000 years, including Palna Brón. When you look at the biodiversity, which is my job here as a student, you wouldn't have that biodiversity were it not for grazing practices, and you wouldn't have the grazing practices were it not for the farmers. And even the geology, the bare karst landscape that we have here, that was completely wooded once upon a time. But Bronze Age, Stone Age farmers would have cleared away the woodland by hand and using fire to expose the landscape that we celebrate today. So everything about this place speaks back to farming.
But when you talk about traditional farming methods and how traditional farming methods are really what has preserved this marvellous flora and fauna of the burn, what is traditional farming in this area?
Well, like everything else in the burn, it's a bit odd, it's a bit different. So it's very much a pastoral landscape. They say where the cowman and not the ploughman is king. So it's all about grazing. But the burn is unusual in the sense that water is a big limiting factor. So in summertime, the burn is hot, it's really dry. Cattle can't really survive there. Whereas in wintertime, there's plenty of rain, the limestone's still quite dry and relatively warm. So years ago, farmers started this practice of winter grazing, where they put the cattle out on the hills for the entire winter, let them browse back the dead vegetation, drink the calcium-rich water and lie on the dry lie, as they call it, of the limestone. And that practice of winter grazing is integral, particularly to the biodiversity, because if you didn't have that winter grazing, if you had it in summertime, the cattle would basically eat the flowers, the flowering heads, you'd have no flowers. But if you took away grazing entirely, the burn would revert to its natural cover of scrub and woodland, which is wonderful. But then you lose all your orchids and your gentians, and the monuments start to fall and fade. So farming has enhanced the landscape. And if we want to look after the burn into the future, we have to do it with people. And I think that's the magic part of the burn, that we can do it. We've shown we can do it here.
Yeah. The name Brenton Dunford is synonymous with a great initiative called Burn Life. Can you tell us a bit about that, Brendan?
Yeah, we set up Burn Life, and I say we because I'm only a small part of it. But back when I finished my research and told the story as best I could of farming and the burn, the good, the bad and the ugly, farmers really appreciated the fact that for once they were included in the picture, in the story of the burn. And then they came on board with solutions. So we applied to Europe for some funding to develop a blueprint for farming in the burn. And the farmers were 100% on board, as were conservation authorities. And thus was born a little project called Burn Life, where we worked with farmers for 5 years and scientists and co-created a plan as how best to manage the burn in a way that gave farmers a decent living, but looked after the landscape as well. And it was so successful, it won a lot of awards, and that was really down to the involvement of the farmers, led by a great man called Michael Davron. But it was so successful that it unlocked funding from national government to roll it out across the burn in a programme called the Burn Programme. And we ran that for 12 years with about 350 farmers covering about 80% of the burn. And every single year we could prove scientifically that the environmental health of the burn was improving as a result of working with farmers to preserve the environment.
And there's another institution which is probably much better known called Burn Bio. How did the local people, both farmers and others, how did they buy into this idea of Burn Bio?
Well, Burn Bio is just such a beautiful project. We're so proud of it. My late wife, Anne O'Connor, she was a real dynamo. She had a lot of skills around web development, and I had this great story from my research. So we kind of combined forces to sort of build Burnbio as a way of telling people the fuller, richer story of the burn. Mm. I think the reason that the farmers bought into it so much is they felt that their story was being told honestly and that they were being included and that the burn was no longer a place of experts abstracting knowledge, but that their Indigenous knowledge was being shared and being valued and being applied in terms of the solutions that I described through the burn programme before.
And tell me just, Brendan, at the moment, how optimistic are you about farming and the burn, with people being able to make a living and raise their families here?
So I think I'd be optimistic about the future farming if we can reimagine what farming is, that is about more than food production, that farming, when done well, can be about sustaining biodiversity, it can be about education and recreation, it can be about health, it can be about sustaining, you know, our built heritage, the walls and so on. If we can do that and then generate income streams to support farmers to continue in this landscape, I do think there's a bright future here because the burn is amazing. The burn is amazing. People have survived for 6,000 years and hopefully for 6,000 more as well.
Winter paths. There is something about winter which pares all living things down to their essentials. A bare tree, a black hedge hold their own stark thrones in our hearts. Once, after searching a valley, summer after summer, I went in winter and found at last the path that linked the well to the little roofless churches. A crooked way through fields. Leafless, fruitless, the briar-bound stone walls revealed their irregular gaps. The way cattle and goats and women and men had passed winter after winter, drawing aside or shoving past stray strands of briar, wondering if they'd know their way again in summer. I'm now at the Seven Churches, an ecclesiastical settlement in a beautiful dip, sheltered dip, at the end of the valley of Octomama. And with me is art historian Silvina Martin, who is doing a PhD in archaeology on Corcomroe Abbey and the surrounding area, which includes the settlement at the Seven Churches. Now, Silvina, tell me, what have we got here?
Well, we have three churches, and we have a mill site with a mill race, agricultural terraces, other kind of buildings, and a holy well, all in ruins.
When does it date from, do you think?
It might have been founded by Coleman.
That's 6th century, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah, this is 6th to 7th century.
But these buildings here, they don't date from the 6th century?
No, because the buildings will have been made of wood. And from in Ireland, from the year 900 on, they started to replace the wooden buildings with stone buildings. You see these structures here? There were relatively big buildings here, probably for habitation or for, you know, workshops. We will not. This place hasn't been excavated, but maybe there was one of the reasons people would think there were seven churches. I'm not sure, because the place is called Seven Churches, but there are only three.
So you think they might have been agricultural buildings or storage?
Or just for habitation.
For habitation.
Yes, yeah. We don't know.
So this is where the mill was originally?
Yeah, this is the side of the mill. Uh-huh. Well, actually above us. It's in a hollow, and this is an artificial construction. You see the stones? So the mill was placed in the top, probably a wooden construction. The water will flow where we are now, and here will be an horizontal wheel.
A horizontal wheel?
Yes, typical of Irish mills of the time.
So where is the mill race that fed the mill?
It's over there. Well, this funnel-like construction is the mill pond that's between the mill race and the mill.
And I'm looking here at the mill race. Is this a natural or an artificial construct?
It's artificial. What we see here is just a part. It's actually, this is 100 meters long.
Oh, I see.
And it's 2 meters deep, 5 meters wide, and the edges are reinforced and constructed with stones. You can see it. And the mill race had to be insulated also, so the water will not absorb again. Yes.
So how did they insulate it?
I don't know, because we haven't had any...
No excavation.
No excavation.
It will have to be excavated.
With materials that don't let water through. And have you realized we have no rivers here?
I was just going to say, what water?
Exactly. There is no rivers, but there are a lot of water sources. Over there, if you come in winter, it's just waterfalls. And they manage to collect this water in this pond, 100 meters long, and direct the water to the mill.
I've heard some suggestion that it's possible that the people building Corcomroe Abbey, the Cistercians, might have lived for a while at Uchtmama. Do you think there's any truth in that?
It could be. Definitely, a mill here is a very, very interesting object for the Cistercians. And typically, they will have taken over because the Cistercians were very invasive.
So the mill predated the arrival of the Cistercians?
I would say so, yes. Yeah. But as I say, there is no excavation, but it's very probable.
I'm on my way now to the ruined abbey off Corcomroe, a Cistercian abbey in a beautiful place with a very beautiful name, St. Mary of the Fertile Rock. I'm here now in St. Mary of the Fertile Rock, Santa Maria de Petris Fertilis, beautiful soaring Cistercian abbey built at the end of the 12th century, beginning of the 13th century. And it was founded by one of the O'Briens. Some say the Dunamore O'Brien, some say his son. It was built on the edge of their territory and on the edge of O'Loughlin territory, and there was huge rivalry between the O'Briens and the O'Loughlins. All Cistercian abbeys are very elegantly proportioned, but this one is rather different in that there's quite a bit of ornamentation. The tops of the capitals are beautifully carved with little flowers. Some say they're the flowers of the Burren. I can see something that looks like Lily of the Valley up here. There is a marvellous tomb here, Conor na Suadhna O'Brien, who was killed in battle here at the end of the 13th century. There's a beautiful stone effigy of Conor laid out in a tunic. His feet are resting on a little stone at the end and lovely curled hair. And I'm afraid, not the first poet to be drawn to Corcomroe. A much more eminent poet, W.B. Yeats, set one of his plays here, The Dreaming of the Bones. We're going to move outside the ruin now to look at another, much more modern grave, the grave of a local musician, Chris Droney. Chris Droney, of course, was a wonderful concertina player. He died in 2020 at the great age of 95, and he has a most delightful memorial, because at the bottom there's a little tune has been engraved. And at the back of the monument is this concertina, which brings back to me the beautiful music which he played, lovely Clare concertina playing. And I couldn't help putting him into this poem about the beautiful ruined abbey of Corcomroe. It's called St. Mary of the Fertile Rock. On the capitals of the columns of Corcomroe, the limestone bells of Lily of the Valley ring out their stone blessings. More than 800 years since an abbot and 12 grey-robed friars arrived from Inishlonacht in Tipperary, and under O'Brien's lordly eye were granted a valley with 5 wells. They brought a Cistercian yardstick to a landscape of rounded, goat-haunted, cave-riddled hills, and measured out the rigid lines of a high, harmonious stone abbey. The valley's slope is still striped with long green fields, the labor of a thousand monks. But by the gate, the hospital is a shell, the abbey well a hoof-churned mud field. The great thatch is centuries fallen. The stone flowers are weathering. An O'Brien king killed nearby in battle sleeps near to an O'Loughlin rival, while Buddha-like a stone bishop smiles down. No visible trace remains of the battles and burnings, of the vyings of dynasties and clerics, or of the heartfelt prayers of centuries poured up to heaven. Outside, the cloister is crowded with graves of the long dead and the lately dead, of the pompous and the poor. But in a corner shines an old concertina player's granite gravestone, engraved with one last lively tune.
Especially the cuckoo is here. There's a total chorus of birds here, and the peace and quiet of the birds, particularly in the spring. Lovely.
I was talking earlier to Brendan Dunford of Burnbio about farming in the Burren, and he said, well, you should talk to somebody who knows about it, and nobody knows better, I'd say, than Michael John Connolly. And we're here on his own land in the beautiful, beautiful Valley of Uchtomama. We've been talking to several people who have fallen in love with the Burren, who've come to live here, but you're off the land here. Has your family been here for long, Michael John?
Well, my father was from Kinvara.
Uh-huh.
My mother was from down the road.
What sort of farming do you do around here? What kind of farming do you do?
Nowadays, it is mostly suckler cows. In the area, there's probably 2 milking herds, but most of them are livestock, dry cattle, and as I say, suckler cows.
And what's it like farming in this, you know, sort of really very beautiful, but at times stony place?
It keeps you fit. You have to climb over those hills there during the winter when we put the cows up there for at least three months, starting from the 1st of October.
And I occasionally hike up there, and it's a great mystery to me how the cattle don't break their legs up there. It's so.
Well, they get used to it, you know. Yeah. There's paths that you can bring them into, then they find their way through the place.
And what kind of satisfaction do you get from farming these days? What do you enjoy about it particularly?
Well, I enjoy it more now than I did in the past. When I was about 12 and a half years old, my father got sick, and there were 6 of us in the family, and I had to stay home from school to do the farming. So I was working horses from, doing it all with the horses when I was 40. Anyway, we had tillage. Tillage was the big thing in this area.
And what would you have been growing?
We grew wheat, which was very prized in those days, and you grew barley for Guinness, oats for your horses and your sheep and your hens and your ducks. And we grew probably an acre of potatoes for yourselves, like, you know, feeding them to pigs and everything, you know. That's changed completely. As you can see, there's no tillage here.
Not a bit, just cattle. Actually, beautiful cattle. I came here first. I just picked out this place on Tim Robinson's beautiful map of the Burren, and I said, oh, there's a very interesting looking place. There's a well, and there are little 12th century churches, and there's a Cistercian abbey, and I hitchhiked down here. But I've been coming to the well since, a very, very special place, and only once did I meet anybody at it. A man was doing the rounds at the well. But he told me that he was back from England. He came every year because he had a pain in his ear when he was a child. It was a pattern day, and his uncle brought him up here. The pain went away, and every year he comes back, he said, in Thanksgiving. Would you have been aware of that pilgrimage to the well?
Oh, indeed. Yeah, very much so, because the patron day was the 5th of November, St. Coleman's Day. And at that time, people would arrive. I mean, you'd see people coming out over that mountain. I remember as a kid, and over here, people coming to visit the well.
And when did that die out?
I'd say go back 40 years more, I'd say.
And when you were growing up, I mean, how aware would you have been of the rich archaeology around here? You're very interested in it now, I know. Would you have been aware of it growing
Not
up?
Not in the slightest.
Really?
No, because nobody talked about it, and it wasn't a thing that was going to make you any money, you know.
Yeah. So,
anyway, it was later on that we got interested in the whole archaeological thing of the burn.
There was an archaeological dig up on the top of Turlough Hill here a number of years ago, and it was a Stefan Berg.
Yes,
was
Stefan Berg. Right, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah, tell us
an
about
archaeologist
it.
From Sweden who worked to the Galway University. The last day of the dig, I made my way up there, and they had a group of people. He had 15, I suppose, down on their knees with spoons. It was the coldest day of the year. I don't know how that stuck up. But anyway, that was the final day. So I said, did you find anything? He said, we found half a hazelnut. And I said, didn't I tell you that? Did you were unlikely, because I always believed that, you know, why would you leave a big settlement of people above in the highest hill of the place? So I always considered that it had to be a ceremonial site or a big gathering for all the tribes in the burn, maybe, you know, going to piss up or something like that, you know.
A festival like Slane or something.
A bit like that, but
yeah,
I don't know.
Slane,
we don't know what they were playing.
Yes, we don't.
Maybe they were only playing Podgy, we don't know.
The takeaway, in a way, was to have been hazelnuts.
As well as that, they found what they call the hearth, where there was a fire. It was sent to Sweden for analysis. It came back as 11 to 800 BC. So it was, that's very interesting, you know.
And here you are, looking after this beautiful land so well. And it's gorgeous today, absolutely gorgeous.
Absolutely,
yeah.
It is gorgeous.
Where's that cuckoo that we heard earlier? It's gonna hide now when we want to hear it. Now we're going to head up to the highest point of all, to Turlough Hill, where we have the Iron Age enclosure and the late Stone Age, I think, burial mound. And there's a view from it right out over the bay and over into Galway. A very, very special corner of the burn. Finishing this programme at the top of Turlough Hill. On my first visit here, I didn't realise that even older than the pre-Christian Holy Well were the settlements on the top of the mountain, the burial mound, and an enormous enclosure where archaeologists surmise people probably came from all parts of the Burren and also from the plains of East Galway. And I can't help surmising that perhaps one of the things that brought people here, besides the fact that it's a natural boundary between the highlands and the lowlands, between Connacht and Munster, is the sheer beauty of the view. And I have attempted to capture some of this in a poem. So I'm going to finish the programme with this poem called Turlough Hill, for Margaret Duffy and Pascal Bradley. To climb up through blossom and sharp-edged stone as into a song. This huge, angled hilltop enclosure asks 100 questions, yields few answers. Did people sacrifice here? Or bring their beloved dead for ravens to carry their earth essence into an untroubled sky? Was this a court of law, a place of congress for many tribes, a place of festival at harvest time? Because nobody wrote, nobody will ever know. Yet, with its many entrances, this was no fortress. Early peoples who came here also left a high burial mound, foundations of 100 huts and scattered hazelnut shells. Today, exhausted at the hilltop, we are rewarded with rapture under a high sky, with a new sweep of vision out past Bell Harbour to the islands and the glittering sea, to the stepped and light-shaken, the flower-filled catacombed hills, to the valley and the far green plains. And the sharing of all of this with those we know and those we don't, with the companion beside us, with those who built this great enclosure, and those still centuries from birth, is like the sharing of a dance or a song, like the sharing of any beauty, any pain, a soul marking, an enduring bond.
A Corner of the Burn was presented by Moya Cannon, with contributions from Mary Angela Keane, Killian Roden, Brendan Dunford, Silvina Martin, and Michael John Connolly. Moya Cannon's poetry is published by Carsonet, and we heard poems from her collected poems and her most recent collection, Bunting's Honey. Music in the programme was from the albums Down from Bell Harbour and The Flowing Tide, and it was performed by Jacinta McAvoy and the late concertina player Chris Droney. The producer was Claire Cunningham, and the programme was a Rockfinch production for RTE Lyric FM. The programme is available to podcast on the usual podcast platforms and on the RTE radio player. The programme was funded by the RTE Independent Radio Production Unit and Cumasún na mBan from the television licence fee.
You're listening to the Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
The series producer is Owen O'Kelly, and the production coordinator is Michael O'Kane.
But that's not all on this week's Lyric Feature, for we have some bonus content for you now. Anya Murray is no stranger to this corner of the Lyric schedule. She's presented numerous documentaries over the years, including the series' Root and Branch and Feather and Flock, which dealt with trees and birds, respectively, and featured herself and multi-instrumentalist and folk singer Brian McLynn running the rule over our natural world. But she's also been doing the same thing every Saturday morning on Daybreak, where her Nature File column has been going out for, I think, 7 years now. She recently launched a book, Frog Roots and Polka Dot Newts, which features a number of columns from that Nature File series. And it seems like a perfect time to play her column on the burn from 2018. So this is Anya Murray's Nature File, The Burren.
Every time I visit the Burren in County Clare, I'm startled at the dramatic change in the landscape when I arrive. The feel of the place is so unlike anywhere else, with gigantic rocky expanses sweeping gently skywards. Its topography is strikingly different. The landscape is far rockier and drier than anywhere else in Ireland. The plant life, too, is extraordinary. Alpine plants grow alongside Arctic species amid the nooks and crannies of limestone and in the fields of thin glacial soil. Botanical oddities abound in a floral medley that has fascinated naturalists for centuries. Farming practices in the Burren are different too, the outwintering of cattle in the uplands being a reversal of how we farm in the rest of the country. And of course, it's all these anomalies that make the Burren so special. Burren means rocky place in Irish. The limestone that characterises the Burren was set down over 300 million years ago, as tiny calcium-rich creatures fell to the bottom of a shallow tropical sea. At that time, the landmass that is now Ireland was located near the equator. In the intervening 300 million years, the land has moved slowly northwards. But the limestone rock that is so exposed in the Burren is a legacy of our sojourn in the tropics. Limestone has particular characteristics, one of which is the way it gets eroded by water. In the Burren, all the surface water disappears underground, creating subterranean rivers and caverns. Disappearing waters leave the land surface dry for much of the year, and this dryness is the key to many of the Burren's special characteristics. Without water, it's impossible to keep cattle out on the higher ground during summer months. Instead, cows are kept in the lowlands through the summer and only let out to graze on the higher ground during winter. This traditional farming system, unique to the Burren and thought to date back to the Celts, is called winterage. Early people left other marks on the landscape too. There are hundreds of Neolithic portal tombs, Bronze Age wedge tombs, and thickly built ancient stone walls and ring forts to explore. The low-level grazing during summer months allows a myriad of wildflowers to flourish, with winter grazing clearing away the excess growth and keeping scrub at bay. Many visitors to the Burren are surprised at the barrenness at first sight, but hidden mysteries abound. To experience the floral magic of the Burren, one has to get up close and explore the nooks and crannies of the limestone. A multitude of flowers keep a low profile among the limestone pavement and the grassy swards of the stone-walled fields. The most famous of the Burren's wildflowers is a striking blue beauty called the spring gentian. But outside of the Burren, spring gentian is known as an Arctic alpine plant. Its occurrence in Ireland is an oddity. Another Arctic alpine plant that grows in abundance in the Burren is the bloody cranesbill. Its luminescent bright pink flowers abound in the little hollows of the exposed limestone pavements. Alongside these Arctic and alpine plants grow the dense flowered orchid, a flower that normally grows only in the Mediterranean. Of the 27 orchid species that occur in Ireland, 22 are found in the Burren. There are hundreds of wildflowers at home in the Burren. The wonder is that many of these are normally found in severe alpine and Arctic conditions, and they live happily side by side with plants normally found only in Mediterranean regions. The Burren has a truly eclectic mix of the most wonderful wildflowers. All this diversity of flowering plants provides a habitat for an incredible array of bees and the widest variety of butterflies and moths anywhere in the country. The great yellow bumblebee, which is threatened with extinction here in Ireland, is just a recent discovery. Other rare bee species include the shrill carder bee and the red-shanked carder bee. Carder bees shred up plants to build their nests, similar to how we card raw wool in order to spin yarn. In the same way the geology determines the farming traditions, the practice of outwintering the cattle allows an incredible array of wildflowers to set seed in summer and thrive. And these wildflowers provide a wonderfully diverse pantry for the pollinators to prosper. Nothing is quite as it should be in the Burren. Every step you take reveals new wonders. The dazzling combinations of Arctic, Alpine and Mediterranean plants, the exposed rocky surfaces with a wealth of wildlife, are all part of the complex ecosystem which make up this rich cultural landscape. The Burren is indeed a rare jewel in the crown of this Emerald Isle.
Anya Murray there on the Burren from her Nature File columns that air each week at 9:15 on Yvonne Ferguson's Daybreak. and Anya's book, Frog Roots, Polka Dot Newts and Other Treasures of Irish Nature, is published by Gill Books and is available widely.